Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Outcast with wealthy dowager David Berry and me, local farmhand Tim Downing. Today we begin fracking in the rich and fertile Outlander wilderness, bulldozing our way through the delicate ecosystem to unearth the untold riches hidden beneath. And we've certainly struck gold this week. An actress and musician whose work takes in The Commitments, Orphan Black, The Tudors, Downton Abbey, Dexter, Father Ted. I mean, come on. And of course, playing the wonderful Jocasta in Outlander. She's released 9 solo studio albums and continues to write and tour extensively. She is, of course, the brilliant and mercurial Maria Doyle Kennedy. Welcome.
Hello. Welcome. Hi.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us in our Outlander wilderness, ready for the fracking, jumping right in. We have our usual scene that we are about to play with a three-hander, if you will. And today we have chosen, it's episode 506. This is before the locusts arrive. Locusts. And it is a lovely, lovely little scene with Roger and Brianna. And how are we divvying out the parts, ladies and gentlemen? How are we going to do this? We have Roger, Brianna, and of course, the very important, holds it all together, the glue, the stage directions.
Well, I'm going to do the stage directions because I'm just dying to listen to the two of you do Roger and Brianna, to be honest. So I'll do that. And also because they're talking about Jocasta's character. So it would be a good observational exercise for me to re-listen to the scene and what they actually thought about me, Jocasta.
Are there any locusts in this scene? Could I be a locust? Could that be a possibility here? A talking part is a locust. Look, I'm ready. I'll dive in. I'll dive in, Tim. I'm good.
All right.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
Interior, Rogers Ridge, Roger and Brianna's cabin. A squalling Jemmy McKenzie bounces on Roger Wakefield McKenzie's knee. Roger wipes at Jemmy's runny nose with a handkerchief while Brianna McKenzie tends the fire.
I hate this Scottish accent. I think we all know that I can't do one and I'm...
You're in for a real treat, Maria. Real treat. Honestly, if you were to close your eyes, you could be anywhere. Like in Iceland.
What was my...
That's how far north he's going
to... I need to channel Russian, though, wasn't it? Let me think. Come now, laddie. Just a wee sniffle. It's not so bad. No, okay.
That's pretty good.
Roger, look at the handkerchief. It's covered in snot.
Yeah. What I wouldn't give for a box of tissues.
Awesome baby aspirin. I don't know where I'm from, but... I think I've got the right level. Awesome baby aspirin.
Okay. Wait, I'm back in the scene. Hold on.
Back in the scene.
Though I suppose it wouldn't make much difference. How is it that 200 years from now, we have a man on the moon, but still no cure for the bloody common cold?
You could have gone to the wedding, you know? I can handle a kid with a cold.
I know. But I wanted to help.
Jocasta insulted you at our wedding. So you thought you'd insult her by not going to her?
I'm sorry, Tim. This is what happened.
This is wonderful
doing this
stuff.
As a scene,
there's nothing funny.
I think I might break. You're being very respectful of my accent. But something about what you're saying is just setting me off here.
I don't know what it is. I've got no idea. This is good stuff. I've given it both barrels.
Can you give me that feed line again?
Yes. Here we go.
Please.
Jocasta insulted you at our wedding. So you thought you'd insult her by not going to hers?
Well, two birds with one stone.
Brianna notices Adzo toying with something.
Edsel's brought us a gift.
She picks it up, examining it. It's a dead locust, she jokes.
Just what I always wanted.
Suddenly, a thwack. Roger crosses to the window. A locust is crawling on the glass. He looks down and sees two more locusts crawling on the floor of the porch. A foreboding pall falls over him.
Now, Tim, I know you're going to be with me on this. I detected a little bit of, like, Southern Belle in what you just did. And I was wondering if we could take this in a different direction here. Just go with me on it. I didn't think it's a gift from Adsel. And I hope it's not a gift from the gods.
I like it.
Yeah? Bit of Tennessee Williams.
I don't even think you can see the join. That's how much I liked it. From being Irish, but no, from being sort of Scottish Russian to New Orleans. I liked it. I thought it was good.
I'm somewhere in Tennessee Williams. I'm Brick. I don't know. I'm Big Daddy.
Big Daddy.
Is that the end of the scene? Are Definitely. We done?
That's the end of the scene. That is the end of the scene, and that's where it all.
I was just gearing up for a Tennessee Williams kind of melodrama.
I know. I mean, we are more than welcome. I mean, you could carry on. Is there another little bit? No, it cuts out and it goes back to Jamie and Claire. And then you appear, actually, about two or three scenes later, you appear. Now, that would be a treat. Goodness me.
A gentleman caller.
A gentleman caller, quite. But very interesting. Actually, reading that back, not only do we mention common cold, but then also plagues of locusts. So, interestingly, two worlds combining there 300 years ago. Interesting. And we are now about to suffer the worst recession for 300 years. So a lot going on in that scene.
Oh.
So that is very, very exciting.
Thanks for pointing that out, Tim.
Thanks very much. I thought I'd give everyone a bit of a lift. I think that's always very important. Maria, your character within this is very special because obviously she is an unmarried woman that has a lot of money, which is quite a rarity. And I did a little bit of kind of digging around and having a look around at things at a few statistics about that period and women in that particular period. And I have two in particular that I think might be vaguely interesting, but I'll hit you with them.
Go on.
The first one is the Mayflower. Now, obviously, everyone talks about the Mayflower and how wonderful and all that, and the bringing the pilgrims and everything. But statistically, on board, there was 102 people that sailed from Plymouth, from Portsmouth. 18 married women. 7 unmarried women traveling with parents and 3 young unmarried women and a girl. And then there were 73 men. 3/4 of the women died in the first few months while the men were building houses, drinking fresh water. The women were confined still to the ship. So by the time of the first Thanksgiving, there was only 4 women left.
Wow.
Isn't that extraordinary? I never heard that before. That's never kind of part of the talk about the Mayflower. Anyway, that was obviously about 100 years before this. But then it comes on to... and this feeds into your character, is married women and single women at this period. And during this particular period in the 1700s, you could vote if you were a single woman. And there was only, in America, in the mid-1700s, early 1800s, there was only one registered woman voter in the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And then it changed during the in 18-something, where that vote was then taken away. But if you're a single woman and a free black slave, you could vote. But if you were a married woman, you couldn't vote because you were seen as property. And so therefore your husband would vote instead.
Yes. And I think that was not a federal law either, Tim. I think it was different state to state.
Very much. Yeah, very much.
Certainly one of the things I thought about a lot for Jocasta because, if you're thinking about who you're going to be or who you're going to pretend to be, you want to find some reason why they are that way. And, I think she's amazing. I'm absolutely mad about her. But she's fairly hardcore. Like she's sometimes kind and practical and resourceful, but she's also like she's deeply manipulative as well. And she's very astute. She plays people off against each other all the time. But I really began to think about the time and how she would have survived as a woman there once her husband had passed. And she really had to be, you know, really, really on her toes, way ahead of everybody else in order not to have her plantation and wealth and title taken from her. So it gave me a lot of encouragement, I suppose, about really playing her, you know, fairly hard, that she's endured a lot to get there. First of all, we know she left Scotland and she lost all of her children along the way. And then she gets there with Hector, and then he goes too. So it explained a lot to me about how resourceful and what, there's some word I'm looking for to describe what her behavior, but I can't think what it is now. But imagine being her and just thinking that at any moment, a foot wrong and your neighbors or the local Lieutenant Wolf or they'll be in and they'll have it and you'll be out of there.
I was thinking the word might be Machiavellian, or maybe even, you thought this whole kind of thing came out of nothing, this whole Tennessee Williams reference that I was pulling out of nowhere. But she lives in the South, and much like Liz Taylor, maybe, she's had many husbands as well, hasn't she?
Yes, she has.
There we go.
She likes a good engagement ring. Yeah.
There we go. Look, I'm not entirely bringing stuff just out of thin air, but I could possibly be doing that. But she does have an element of that
complicated Southern woman,
and just the fact she, I don't know, she has to be so independent, and also doesn't seem to want to be dependent on a man.
Absolutely. And she, I mean, you know, we know that she had three husbands and is, you know, chatting to a fourth in season five. And she seems to utterly have made those moves purely for survival. She put survival above everything else. And I suppose that she gave up so much to get there. She gave up, as we've said, her children and her life in Scotland and her heritage, everything she knew, the land she was from, all of the rest of her family. So I suppose she will do anything to make that be worthwhile. And survival is the only way to prove that, I suppose. To survive is everything for her. To have River Run, to have her status in the local community, and the power that she does have from her sawmills and her indigo and all of that stuff, that the wealth that she's created. She's very proud of that. And she's clearly good at it, because she has managed to maintain it and keep it. But also there's this kind of feeling from her that she has to hide it as well. She has to hide how clever and how capable she is, because again, that would upset the local powerful men and they would figure out a way to take her down. So it's really interesting. In the male characters in that same situation, you see them much more openly swagger and boast and display their wealth and their power. And as a woman, she can't do that. So it's this constant conflict of, she has control and leverage, but she has to, you know, be sneaky and inventive and creative about it, as opposed to open.
Yeah, women through history have had to do that. If we think back to some really great women roles that are in the dramatic literature, I think one that comes to mind is Lady Macbeth, who can't really do what she wants, but uses almost Macbeth as her instrument. She has to be very, she's really the one who's coming up with all the schemes behind the Macbeth, and he's the man of action. And yet the way that we judge her is so different to the way that we judge Macbeth. Macbeth is the hero, and yet Lady Macbeth is seen as the villain of the piece. And I don't think that that's really justified.
Totally. Isn't that the way of the world? Don't we judge women and men differently anyway on their behavior? If we think even now, you know, in our political world, the fate of women and men is so different. In a much smaller way, but I do always find when I'm being interviewed that people ask me about how I manage to juggle my parenting and my work, and they never ask my husband that. And you know, there's a constant difference, but I mean, it's up to us to change that. I mean, it's really about fairness for me. It's about equality of opportunity, and And I think once we recognize that it isn't there for everybody, then we can go about dismantling the way things are done, or changing it, or making things more fair. Yeah, more diverse, more fair, more pathways into things for people.
Yeah, and dismantling those power structures, absolutely. I imagine that's one of the things that playing the character, you definitely had to be very cognizant of. In many ways, we have changed a lot, but also haven't changed at all.
Well, there's a way to go in all of our worlds, in acting and in the real world, you know, and everywhere we are, there's inequality, and there's things that we can do about it. Even just small, constant changes and awareness do, you know, move things forward. The things have changed so much in the last 20 years in Ireland, it would just make you feel encouraged, and it would make you feel that that your vote matters. For instance, you know, we managed to change fairly significant things here as a country. So yeah, I feel encouraged and empowered to go on, I have to say. And even Jocasta, I mean, as an actress, I mean, I'm 55 now, and, you know, to be, everyone told me that I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't work after 37 or whatever. And I refuse to obviously believe that or accept it, but it's great. And I love that in our show, I love that they showed an older couple who were passionate about each other as well, and who clearly had a, you know, desire for each other. I was really glad to see that. It's not obviously something you see a lot of in television. So it was another interesting part of her world for me.
Music has always played a massive part in your life.
Yeah.
And I think you recently described it as being like nourishment, being like food.
Yes.
So you just talk a little bit about that, about how and what music does for you and has done for you.
Well, I mean, I guess I still consider myself a singer who does a bit of acting. And I got my first job by accident. I never went to drama school. So I learned everything on the job. So what happened with the Commitments was they had been looking around. They'd gone and auditioned a whole load of different people, and they hadn't quite found what they were looking for. So they just did an open call. I basically saw a poster in a bar that said, "Can you sing? You know, would you like to be in a film? Call this number or something." So I did call, and I was in a band at the time. I've been singing ever since I was in college, and met some like-minded people who also played instruments and wanted to be in a band, and started playing in bands then. So anyway, they knew my band, so I got in, and I read again, whatever. I got the job. But so that was really, it was a really fun time. I made some great friends, but I kind of thought that was a one-off experience. I sort of said, well, I could do that because I know what it's like being in a band. So I know what this action means. I know what the story means. I know how to tell it. And it wasn't quite my accent, but it was very close. So I didn't really think I would do any more acting. And then I went to visit someone on a set about a year later, and kind of realized how much I missed that whole connection. So then I said, oh, I'll try and do some more. But in the meantime, singing all the time, writing songs. We've been running a record label, our own record label now for, I think, 20 years. And before that, we were signed to other ones. But it's, I wouldn't spend a day without singing, trying to write a song, or singing somebody else's song, or listening to music. I do feel it's like food. And I don't, it's the safest place I can ever be, is singing, really, because I don't think. I'm just there, and I don't worry, and I don't worry. And I, as a person, have a tendency to sometimes maybe think too much, or overanalyze things, or project what if. And I don't do that when I'm singing. I'm calm, and I feel connected to the world also. And it's the thing about a live gig is for 2 hours or something, you just really feel the strength of human connection, that you're all plugged into the same thing and you're just communing. That's, well, it isn't without words because there are the words of the music, but you're just all understanding something on a deeper level than is kind of instruction and receiving. And it's just very, it's just fantastic. And the music as well, that like choral music, I'm not in a choir, but I went to Tallinn last year to the song festival there because I'd heard about it. 30,000 people sing in choirs together at the audience. It was the most moving thing I've ever experienced. It was, I cried and cried and cried. It was so beautiful. And I think it has that power. I think it can almost do anything. It can cut you. Music can make you dance. It can calm you. It can incite you. It can give you encouragement. It can, you know, unite people in some kind of, you know, rallying cry. I can't explain how much it means to. I couldn't imagine a world without music.
Your music is you know, in terms of, it's quite political. It's quite folksy. It's quite rootsy. I was listening to some of your stuff, and it's got quite an Appalachian feel to it, which I adore. It's one of my sort of things that I love, is that type of music. And for some reason, there's something kind of in me that just connects to it. I mean, is there a specific thing about that style of music that connects with you, that makes you go, yeah, it's that style?
Yeah. That was just one album that we made, Tim, called The Storms Around the Ocean. And the reason that we did that was because we found a cassette of Harry Smith made all these recordings in the early 1900s, and he made an anthology of American folk music. We found a cassette of some of his recordings in a jumble sale or something, or a charity shop. And as we drove around with it, it was in the car, and we used to play it in the car all the time, which, as I was saying to you, kind of says a lot more about the kind of car we had at the time, anything else, because it still had a cassette player in it. But one of the children really fell in love with these old folk songs, and so then we decided to, and originally these recordings were from the 1900s, but a lot of the songs were from the 15 and 16 and 1700s. And they had made their way from Ireland and Scotland to America and become sort of part of the Appalachian tradition. So I think in some way we felt, by re-recording them, we sort of rearranged them and changed, made them ours somehow. We kind of felt in a way we were bringing some of them home. So it was interesting. But I mean, mostly we write our own songs, and they would be a little bit different than that. It's more, I never really know what to call our music, but it's more like indie, alt folk. I don't know.
Fabulous. And I think I read somewhere that Kieran is like a frenetic writer, could write an album in like a year. Are you the same, or do you kind of have to wait for the muse to kind of hit you and kind of then have this has to be written now?
I think it's probably, I don't really play an instrument. I play a little bit of piano, enough to work out melodies for myself when I'm doing something, but I don't play an instrument well. And I think that's a big part of it. Like, he plays guitar like, you know, like he breathes. It's just, it's an extension of his body, you know, the guitar. So he'll pick it up at any time and just play and make new melodies. And I'm more percolating ideas for a long time, kind of observe something would happen maybe and I would react to it, or I would see something or a person or observe. I think a lot of all of my work comes from observing things. I suppose a lot of makers of things are like that. I think that's as well with acting, as I was saying, I didn't ever go to acting school. So I got a job, and then a little bit later I got another one. And then I just watched everybody like a hawk. I had the the great fortune to work with some great directors early on, like that, Alan Parker, John Borman, and these fantastic, generous actors. And I think maybe I was lucky as well that I was doing that in Ireland and not somewhere. I mean, I've heard terrible stories about people starting off acting in the States, where there was much less inclusion. Anybody I worked with really was happy to talk and to share what they knew and are happy to be observed doing what they knew. It was, I don't know, I was very lucky, I suppose. And that's the same way with writing songs. People are so fascinating, aren't they? I mean, you watch people on a bus, how they interact with each other, if you happen to be sitting behind them, you know, what they might actually be talking about too. But it's, I don't know, everybody in their worlds are very often not what you expect. It's just writing things and acting, I suppose, has become a good lesson in suspending your judgment. I understand why we have sort of quick judgments. They come from the old part of ourselves that wants to not get into danger. You want to be able to judge situations before you get there and, you know, maybe be prepared to protect or defend yourself or not. But it's such an old, old instinct. And sometimes we use it in a way that we immediately see somebody or a couple or a situation or a house and we slot it into a type, don't we? We go, oh, I've got this. I know that. I know where those people are. I know what they think or what they like. And it's so wrong and it's so limiting. So writing things has made me really call that out in myself and check it and stop it and be open to what I'm going to find out rather than thinking I know it before I get there. It's kind of interesting reflection, I think, on I'm sorry, am I talking too
much?
Not
at all. Not at all.
No, we all want to hear you talk. As you said, people are endlessly fascinating and you are, without exception, fascinating. That's why we have you on the show. I'm endlessly fascinated by Tim as well. I frequently just stare at him.
In disbelief, a lot of the time. Utter disbelief. How does that move around to make decisions? That's what he's thinking.
I know. When we were on set, I would just be looking at you, and you'd be asking why I'd be looking at you, and I would say, well, I just think you're endlessly fascinating.
That's exactly what I would say. And then I'd say, I usually have to get a tea now. And
so I had a habit of doing that with a lot of people, just thinking that they're endlessly fascinating. And I, one of the things that I'm fascinated, Maria, delving a bit more and unpacking this idea between an actor and a singer, speaking as someone who does both, I often find it surprising that people are surprised that those two things might not necessarily go hand in hand. They think that, well, because you're an actor, how dare you be able to sing? Or because you're a singer, then how dare you be able to act? And often when people make that transition, they kind of characterize their work differently. They don't see it in the same way. We always want people to be the one thing. Yeah. But I think artists are almost enriched by having a multidisciplinary approach to the way that they express themselves through art. And I'm wondering how advantageous. What differences do you see by someone who is a singer and the way that they express themselves through their acting?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that sometimes people want you only to be able to only to do one thing. It's easier. Again, it's to do with that sort of saying there's a type or something you recognize and it being only the one thing. But some of the people that I've admired most in my life, I could just see, and we're all looking for signs, aren't we? We're looking for, well, some people just wake up in the morning or they're born and they just know who they are and what they are. I always, you know, most of us look for beacons or signposts or influence. You know I certainly have been influenced by situations I've been in and people I've seen all my life. But some of the people, like Patti Smith, for example, is a really good example. She just always walked her own path. We know her as a singer, obviously. She's an artist. I mean, a painter as well. She takes photographs. She she's a writer, like quite an acclaimed writer. Now, she's always written poetry and bits of prose, but now she's written some books that have been hugely successful. One of them is about to be made into a TV show and stuff. So she was never constrained. And I find that a lot of people I meet, a lot of singers or actors or painters, do several things. And I have no problem with that. I think if the creative door is open in your brain, usually there's different ways you have of telling a story. And I think it's all coming from the same well. It's all coming from you. So I think it's fine.
Yeah, I agree. I think that often in this business, and when it gets commercialized, we often, and the way that humans think, we like to think of things in brands. We don't like it when someone steps outside their brand, you know, like say if Nike started making, you know, went into book publishing or something, we'd be like, well, that's very off brand. You know, we wouldn't like that. But I think in terms of actors and artists, we all like to tell stories. And I think that's something that you said before, Maria, you like to tell stories. And I'm wondering if for you, and maybe you've already touched on this, if music is perhaps more of a pure art for you or pure form of expression than acting?
Well, I mean, the difference is obviously that I write, for the most part, I write my own songs. So the ideas in them, you know, Color Code was about Sandra Bland. A song called Pride was written particularly for the marriage equality referendum in Ireland. And so they're my words. So that's the difference, certainly, between acting. But they definitely, both disciplines have fed each other. I think that our gigs are probably a bit more theatrical as a result of my acting experience. And I think that I go deeper into characters because of songwriting, because I try and really inhabit somebody's mind and not just their physicality. So it's helped each other. But I mean, I'll never be showing you any paintings that I've done because I can't draw. I'm desperate. But I like to doodle as well. And I sometimes find that that's very freeing of your mind, just scribbling with markers and pencils. And I think it all should be open to people. I've always hated, and I still really, the idea of constraint or limitation. And I really abhor the word brand. I mean, in terms of people, I don't see myself as a brand. I see myself as, I hope that I'm going to have some kind of holistic, you know, experience. I don't want to just be an actor or a singer as well. I am a mother and a part of a family and, a sentient human being. And I think all of those things are the whole thing is it's really important to me to have a real life. Success is much less important to me than enrichment and experience. And I guess the idea of success, I had another really wonderful friend, Patrick Scott. He was one of Ireland's most magnificent abstract painters. He's passed away now, but he was a really good friend and a mentor. And his whole thing was, your life is your art. And I just saw him do that. And so I've taken as much as I can from his way of being. Like, having dinner with your friends is part of your art. You know, that's going to feed into your songs or how you perform or how you relate to people or how gracious you are or not, or how self-conscious you are or not. And of course, all of those things change at different times, but that's it. It's all part of you. It's all part of the person. And I'm fine with that. I really am okay with that. Going to do my best at whatever I'm doing at that particular time.
Just touching on this idea about identity and branding, and we all of us have been part of this show, Outlander. And what I find fascinating, particularly with you, Maria, is unlike many of us who are part of the show, you are in no way defined by Outlander because you had an amazing career. And in some ways, you had a very defining career moment with The Commitments. And yet, Outlander, as you've discovered, has invariably changes lives in ways that most of us don't really anticipate, and sort of becomes you in a way that maybe you don't really recognize. Do you identify with that as well in terms of the sometimes overbearance of Outlander on its identity as of you as an artist, or how you're seen as an artist, or has that been different from the ways that the multiple other projects that you've done?
I mean, it's different in terms of its fan base, isn't it? I don't think I've been involved with something that had such an enormous life and expectation and, you know, realization before I ever got near it. You know, it's this huge fan base who come from having read the books and are now invested in the TV series. So that's something that I hadn't experienced before. And I have to say, it's been a positive experience for me. The people have been very welcoming. Initially, I think they were a bit skeptical. I remember when I got the job initially, a lot of people said, you know, on social media said, hello, you know, welcome to the clan, that sort of thing. And there were a few people who said, oh, she's a bit young, I don't think. But then, you know, they got a look at me in the wig with no makeup on. They were like, no, she can look like an old crone, no problem. I'll believe that. I'll take it. I think it's slightly different for me, David, than for you, because my position in the show, first of all, I look entirely different than I do in real life. With the wig and all of the costuming, and I have a totally different accent. So I don't get confronted as much or recognized as much, I wouldn't, as you would, for example. And also, you know...
Ooh, I don't know. I still have a wig and an accent. I'd like to think I'm pretty unrecognizable. You have but go on.
I mean, I think people are invested in... A lot of the fan base would be invested in being in love with you, and they would not be feeling that way about me. So I think in terms of I think what you're talking about is a sort of an impact maybe, or an identification with that character. Mine is so sort of far away from me that people would just go, oh, well, she's probably a really hard old bitch. Maybe they might think that about me. I don't know, but they don't. They don't have expectations from me, I don't think, whereas I think they do with some of the male characters, yours included, and I think there's a lot invested in falling in love with you, so I think that you probably...
Well, maybe when there's a love element involved, people are a bit more invested in your identity. I think I do take a little bit of delight when I open my mouth to fans and they say something like, well, wow, you're Australian. I'm like, yes, I'm Australian. I like the fact that I've fooled you into believing that I can be English. I mean, I like to fool Tim all the time that I'm English. And he's been giving me a lot of instruction, tea at every opportunity, always carry an umbrella, never arrive at a point, don't talk about feelings or anything.
Don't do that.
I know how to be English. No.
Don't do that. That's the surefire. It's much of that, like, you can tell, there are certain tells, I think, within sort of cultural tells. Like, for instance, you know, you can always tell an American if you sit down for dinner because they will always eat just with a fork and not use a knife. Things like that. But you kind of go, aha.
Right.
Yes, I can see you are playing English, but you are not. And the classic tell with an English person is they just won't tell you anything. How are you? Fine. So how's your day been? Moderate. And that's it. And that's it. And that's enough emotion has been shown there to be go, all right, calm down. Good. Didn't ask me a live story.
I always loved this one line that was from the Scarlet Pimpernel that what was his name? The guy that was in with Nell and I.
Richard,
come on,
Richard E. Grant.
Yes, Richard E. Grant played the Scarlet Pimpernel, and I just thought it was just so pimping the way he said. Pimping is not a word that usually associate with the English, but he was the Scarlet Pimpernel after all. Where he was asked, "How are you?" and he said, "Tolerably well." And I was like, "Wow, tolerably well." Who says that?
Yeah.
The Scarlet Pimpernel. That's pimping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's we do have national reputations to maintain, all of us, don't we? And in some ways, I certainly adhere to mine in some ways. But yeah, again, there's more to us than that. But it's fun to play them up, and it is a good testament to your. I think you should be proud of that. I think it's a great testament to your acting that people just go, "Wow, that's a totally different person that I had in my mind." And again, of course, I think. Things like that and, you know, costuming, a wig, an accent for sure, helps separate you from the character for yourself. I find it very helpful to suddenly not be me, to suddenly get all that stuff on and that voice on and go, oh, now I'm her, you know.
Well, in case anyone has ever wondered why Tim grows a mustache, we know the whole psychology behind that, don't we, Tim?
It's my cunning disguise. Because I'm just otherwise I just get mobbed, Maria, everywhere I go. Please just leave me. I'm trying to just get a shop in. That's all I'm trying to do. I'm trying to buy bleach. Please let me be. But there is something so, and I think all actors have this, is there's something so incredibly freeing about being hiding within a character or being able to play out someone else, which is, for me, one of the absolute joys is to be able to kind of find those little kind of shadowy corners of yourself and kind of bring them out and be allowed to bring them out rather than sort of say, oh, no, you don't do that. That's going back to Englishness again. But you don't show this and you don't do that and you don't show that emotion or that's too much or, you know, men don't do all these kind of things that society kind of puts on you. Within performing or being creative, you are told to actively do it, which I find the most liberating and freeing that one can possibly be.
Especially if you're playing someone who's a bit bad.
Oh.
You get to just do terrible things without the real life consequences of your actions. I mean, yay.
I mean, there's nothing better. Nothing better. Oh, great. So I get to rob this bank. Brilliant. And then people actively applaud you. That was very good. The way you did that, very menacing. Whereas in real life, that would be possibly the opposite, I dare say.
I think another thing about the idea of brand, David, in terms of acting, there are actors who you just always know what they're going to do, right? Because they've just created a certain thing and they just...
Sure. Tom Cruise comes to mind. We know what we're going to get when we do a Tom Cruise movie. And I'm quite happy to see a Tom Cruise movie or a Schwarzenegger movie. Absolutely.
But the most exciting people are people who... You know, you don't know what you're going to get. You don't know what
the transformative ones. Yeah, I agree.
And you're going to totally believe them as another person. I mean, they're the most. That's always the most exciting stuff for me to see. Something I don't know what it's going to be, but I know I'm going to believe every word of it. But.
Oh, no, I agree with you. I think that's something that we were told. And I remember in drama school, we had a very, very harsh teacher, a very good teacher, who define actors by the transformative actors or non-transformative actors. And so there's a school of thought that I guess based in maybe Stanislavski that you can be transformative. So we're thinking about maybe a Daniel Day-Lewis, maybe a Johnny Depp, maybe someone who really disappears as a chameleon. And then non-transformative actors, maybe from the school of Meisner, who really thinks that you really can only be the one person or various iterations of the one thing. But of course, there's a sort of pejorative sense in that if you're not transformative, then you're not really an actor, you're just a personality. And I remember one time, it was in our third year in the threes of acting school, we were all seated around and there's 24 of us in the class. And you'd point to each one of us in just this very kind of like, it's like we're being lined up to be at the firing squad. And you go, you transform, you transform, you don't transform, you don't transform. You transform. And he got to me and I can't remember what he said. I can't remember. I was just so in shock whether he said I transformed or not, because some people he said you maybe transform. And I think I was a maybe transform. But ever since this day, I've always had it in my mind that the true aspiration of an actor should be someone who can transform within your own limitations. And I definitely do feel, Marie, that your Jocasta, in spite of the differences that you say between wig and accent and so forth, is something that you've transformed into. And I think that partly due to the costuming and so forth, but I also think it's definitely testament to the work that you said that you do on the internal life of your character. Because the externals are something that you really don't have much control over, but the internal life and the things that really motivate the character are the things that really make you transform.
Thank you very much. Everything to say. I mean, I think a huge part of her, obviously, that informed everything from the get-go is that you can't see. So I can't, mostly, we've spoken about this before, I know in hanging out, David, but I mean, mostly we give our cues and we get our cues from people with our eyes. And I mean, I had obviously kind of thought about it before I showed up to do my first scene and I practiced walking around and trying to navigate the world without using my sight and all of that kind of stuff. But I didn't really really understand what I was going to be doing until the very first scene. And I sat down, and it was with Sam and Katrina. And I suddenly looked over and I suddenly went, oh, fuck, I am not going to make eye contact with anybody for 8 months. I suddenly was overwhelmed with loneliness. I just was, oh, this was a big mistake. I'm not going to be happy. I'm not going to be able to do this. But of course, I just figured out then what to do about sort of defocusing my eyes a little bit and where to slightly get my gaze, you know, slightly pitch my gaze and stuff. And then, of course, I don't have to do it between takes. I'm not a method person. I'm going to be hanging out and talking and looking to you, and then I don't feel lonely when I get to hang out. But it certainly is a big part of her, you know, because it informs the way she moves, the speed at which she moves, and all of those kind of things. So that was a big help as well.
So now we're on this topic of transformation. A lot of the things we talk about with acting is when actors transform into something that someone could potentially play without having to transform. So what we do admire about actors on the one hand can sometimes be the very thing that we don't like about them. So for instance, I play a gay man on Outlander, but I'm not gay. And sometimes I do feel a little bit unnerved by that. I feel I lack a sense of authenticity about that. I'm wondering how you feel about playing someone with a disability. Do you feel that, is it something that you think about, and would you feel more comfortable if the part was someone who actually had a disability? How do you think about that?
I did think about it, of course. And I think about those things in a couple of ways. I mean, if I hadn't had the opportunity to act beyond who I am, you know, things would have been much different for me. Like, for example, I got the chance to play Catherine of Aragon, who's a Spanish queen. Now, I was delighted to get that job and to have the opportunity to do that. But obviously, I had to pretend to have a Spanish accent. And I have pretend to have a Scottish accent with Jocasta, as well as I pretend that my side is. I'm glad to have had, that's acting for me. And I'm glad to have those opportunities. And I think, you know, pretending to be gay or pretending to be straight, you know, acting, doing it straight, as long as the opportunity is there both ways. As long as gay actors are allowed to play straight parts, then, you know, I think that that's fine. And it's an acting skill. You're acting. It's a funny one, isn't it? I just want it to go both ways. I want there to be equal opportunity. I have a son, for example, who has Down syndrome. And recently there have been some really fantastic actors that I've seen who also happen to have Downs. And I think that that's a new kind of opening up of our ideas about who can or can't act or who should or shouldn't get a part in. And that's been a really positive development, I think. Did you see the Peanut Butter Falcon? Is that what it was called? This fantastic film. I think it's Peanut Butter Falcon. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I digress. But it's a beautiful film with a young Down syndrome actor in it. And Shia LaBeouf, it's well worth watching if you haven't seen it. It's really good. I mean, I think that if I hadn't had the chance to do things that are not just part of me, then I wouldn't have had any of the great parts I've had. I wouldn't have been able to do the Tudors and have a Spanish accent. And I'm sure there were lots of people who said, she shouldn't have that job. It should be a Spanish actress. But I'm really glad I did have it. And I mean, I think being able to transform at least a bit is part of acting, you know, using different accents, using different body types and having different motivations and different perspectives. That's what acting is. So, but I just would like the opportunity to go both ways. That's what I was kind of saying.
Is it fairness and representation, maybe? Because I remember, Maria, you sent me a film that you directed and it starred your son who's acting in it.
Yeah.
And I wonder sometimes about the opportunities for him. And I think it's been important that representation for people who experience a whole spectrum of life is there in the arts without taking away from the craft of the actor. And it's hard sometimes to draw the line. What is art? What's fair? But I think that we have to sometimes balance both representation and craft. I think we all agree that Laurence Olivier's Othello was probably a bit on the nose now. We wouldn't be doing that. But we've also seen in recent times the first trans actors and stuff. So I think it's heading in a really interesting and cool way. And maybe the idea of the transformative actor is becoming still something we revere, but also something we have to step away from a little bit as we embrace ideas of representation. I don't know, just an idea.
Yeah, I think it's all really interesting. I just think it needs to be, as you say, fair. It needs to go both ways. If straight actors can play gay roles, then gay actors must also be able to be seen as you know, realistic heartthrob lovers, and you know.
Oh, well, they have been through time. We know this already. Plenty of gay actors in Hollywood,
but less. But I mean, openly gay actors will very frequently be told that they can only play gay characters, and that's not a fair trade. You know what I mean? That's. But I think representation is absolutely. I mean, I made the film. It's just a short film. I made it with Daniel because he didn't really ever see himself represented in film or in stories, and he loves film. And he's a very able young man. And also, I wanted to say something with the film a little bit. A lot of people say about Daniel, or his, Daniel is my son, or his friends, that he is Down syndrome. Now, I would say he has Down syndrome, and it's the tiniest difference of a word, but that is the reality of it. Daniel has Down syndrome, along with an absolutely truckload of other DNA that he has inherited from both of our families, and a personality the size of a small country. He's an extraordinary individual. But I wanted, again, I suppose, maybe back to the idea that we spoke a little bit earlier on about judgment, about people seeing him and maybe deciding already things about his ability or lack of ability. And so I just wanted to challenge that a little bit.
Well, Maria, thank you so much for being, as David has said, thank you so much for being our outcast today. And I think we're going to have a song from you. Not live, but a song from you to play us out. So would you like to tell us a little bit about the song that you have chosen?
Well, I thought, as we were talking so much about that time, the 1700s and Jocasta and everything, I thought maybe we'd play one of those songs that we found from Harry Smith's American Folk Anthology. Originally, this is the version we heard was a Carter family version of this song, but it's certainly they adapted it from older folk songs. And I think I would sing it, especially this time, for all the people who, through what's going on in the world at the moment, have been separated from their loved ones or finding it hard to visit or to get to see in real life the people that they're missing.
Maria, thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Going away to leave your love, going away a while. I'll return to you sometime if I go 10,000 miles. The storms are on the ocean, the heavens may cease to be. This world may lose its motion, love, if I prove false to thee. Who will dress your pretty little feet? Who will glove your hand? Who will kiss your rosy red cheek when I'm in a far off land? The storms are on the ocean, the heavens may cease to be. This world may lose its motion, love, if I prove false to thee. Thank you. heavens may cease to be. This world may lose its motion of if I prove false to be.
You have been listening to Outcasts.
Please remember to rate, subscribe, and leave a review, as it all helps.
Follow us on our Instagram page at outcast.podcast for all the latest updates.
Or you can send us an email at outcastspodcastshow@gmail.com.
Every week, we should be selecting a question from one of our listeners to ask our guests.
The theme music is composed by Kieran Ledwidge. All views and opinions expressed on the show are our own and have no affiliation with the series of books written by Diana Gabaldon or the Sony Stars television show Outlander.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast. Although I did have a ham sandwich earlier, so...
See you next time.
See you next time.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.